Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Folklore, which is one of the many podcast channels you can find on the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Hopkin. I'm one of the hosts of New Books in Folklore, and today my guest is Anand Prahlad. Anand Prahlad is, amongst other things, an author, a poet, a musician, and a filmmaker. He's also the director of creative writing at the University of Missouri, where he teaches folklore, film, creative writing, and disability studies. Today, he's going to be talking with us about his recent award-winning memoir, The Secret Life of a Black Aspie. Anand Prahlad, welcome to New Books in Folklore.
Thank you, Rachel.
So normally at this stage, I ask the interviewee how they came to be a folklorist, but in many ways, your book is about that, as well as about lots of other things. So we'll just dive straight into the book. And can you tell us, what was the impetus behind The Secret Life of a Black Aspie? And Aspie, I should say, for listeners who don't know, is a reference to Asperger's syndrome, which is part of the autism spectrum. Is that right?
Yes.
So, yes, tell us how this came about.
Well, I originally started writing it because I needed to write it for myself. And so for some years, as I was writing, I really wasn't thinking of it as a book, and I wasn't thinking of it necessarily that this was going to become a memoir, but I had gotten to a point where I simply needed for myself to express my experience related to being on the spectrum. So that was the impetus, and it was only years later, as I continued to write, that the idea occurred to me that it could become a book. And even after that idea occurred to me, I still wasn't thinking that it would be a book that would ever be published. So when I entered the book in the contest that it won, I got the news that it had won, it was kind of a shock, and I thought about actually not publishing it and not accepting the award. And my wife suggested that publishing the book would be helpful for a lot of other people, so I shouldn't think of it just in terms of myself. So I said yes, and the book was published. So that was the impetus.
It's a memoir that covers most of your life, including your growing up on a plantation in rural Virginia. But it was a very long time before you were diagnosed with Asperger's.
That's right.
So can you tell us a little bit about your childhood in this rural area of Virginia as an African-American with Asperger's, but not knowing you had Asperger's?
Well, in my mind, my childhood was, let's say, not unusual, but that's in my mind because that was all that I knew. So, and I don't have a point of comparison to say, well, my life was different in this way from anyone else who was growing up in a similar area at that point historically. Maybe that's one of the challenges of actually being on the spectrum, is I don't have a good sense of what life is like for people who are not on the spectrum. So I would say, well, I had a normal childhood, but of course, that's not what my mom would say necessarily, or other people who knew me. And in retrospect, the way that I've come to think about it is, it was unusual. Some of the challenges were I was sick all the time. So I spent a lot of my childhood in the bed, and I had a lot of different illnesses that were never diagnosed because growing up in a segregated era, we didn't have any really good medical care. So when people were sick, unless it was something fairly serious, they didn't think in terms of going to a doctor. There was a white doctor in that area in the nearest town, but we didn't go there just because we got sick. We went there when something was more serious. So I don't even know what a lot of those illnesses were. They sometimes had, let's say, folk names, and I don't remember what my parents and grandparents called them. I just remember that I was sick all the time. So that really stands out in my mind as the most unusual thing about my childhood, is that I couldn't do a lot of things that other children could do. And when I did go outside and play or whatever, I would often fall ill, and then I wouldn't be able to either go outside or go to school for a period of time.
Hearing that makes it sound like you had a really isolated childhood, but actually it seems you were surrounded by spirits that populated your life then and continue to do so.
Yeah, I didn't experience it as isolating. I experienced it as I was having a lot of quiet time that I really needed. And in that time, I could relate to spirits, as you mentioned, but I could relate to other things like the birds outside, or the clouds that I could see out the window, or the wind that might blow through the window, or the butterflies that I might see. So I didn't have the feeling of being isolated, because I didn't have the sense that having company necessarily meant having people around.
Right. And of course, you were also dealing with this overload on your senses, because that's part of how the disorder manifests for you. And you have also synesthesia, which I understand is kind of mingling of the senses, where one sense causes you to experience something via another sense as well. So colors, for example, are very strong.
Yeah.
And I know you've got an excerpt specifically describing the sensory overload that you experience. I wonder if I could ask you to read that.
Sure. I can read that. Most of the time, I felt overwhelmed, overstimulated, frustrated, out of control. Things around me moved too fast. People said things and moved on as I waded through the multitude of sounds around me, trying to separate out their words. Until I was around 8 years old, the outlines of shapes around me were fuzzy, and things often seemed to melt into each other. When I first rode on a roller coaster as a young adult, I recognized the noxious, sick feeling of speed and fear as what I had been feeling normally most of my childhood. Almost everything made me sick. My own emotions made me physically sick. The emotions of others around me made me sick. The thoughts of others made me sick. I could hear their thoughts. I could see them floating through the house like crowds of puppets going back and forth across the stage, wearing countless faces, carrying countless weights, like bodies on a crowded street. My thoughts would be lost in the multitude, and I could seldom find them. I came apart like a sack of grain, everything spilling out. I would lie in bed, an empty body, searching desperately to be filled. Touching the wrong spirits made me sick. The cries of objects like the pillows, hose, pots, axes, knife blades, doorknobs, glasses, coins, buttons, tables, and lamps made me sick. The knives were always crying, "Marry me to the bright blood blossoms of your palms, your wrists, your arms, the insides of your thighs." The high pitch of glasses crying almost made me scream. The snoring of the plants when they thought no one could hear them often made me sick. Sometimes it healed me, but the way they shrieked when they heard footsteps approaching made me tiptoe. Sometimes it made me stand still and not move at all, just so they wouldn't be afraid. The brightness of sunshine was the same way, the loud brightness of the sunshine. Some days it struck me down like fire burns up a blade of dried grass. Other days it propped me up like the wood beneath the scarecrow.
That's incredibly evocative. It sounds terrifying in a way, but it also, I think it leads to a sense of the richness of the world in a way that perhaps people without this disorder don't experience.
Well, I'll use your words, a rich terror.
Yes, right. A rich terror. But it's not just terror, is it? Because there are other richnesses that come to you because of this.
No, it's not just terror at all. In fact, I experience it as a kind of pleasure. It's more like too intense pleasure, because those sensations on the one hand are painful, but on the other hand there's something very pleasurable about them.
You describe in the book that you were, like you said, you were sick for quite a long time and missed a lot of school, but even so you were academically very advanced. How did that come about, do you think?
Well, I just had a knack for catching on to things that we learned in school really quickly. So most of the time, whatever we went over in class, I got it right away. And so most of the time that the teacher was spending on it, I was more or less in my own world. And I would tune back in when we started to work on something new. So I don't know why that was the case, but I just had an ability to get things really almost intuitively. So it didn't take me a lot of time.
And I like the way you describe your perspective on things, because you say something like, you never took knowledge to be real or absolute. 2 + 2 = 4, but what is 2? D-O-G spells dog, but it's not the same as a dog. It's a word. It's like semiotic as a high schooler. And around the age of 12, I think you started to develop friendships with other people as opposed to the spirits that surrounded you.
Yes.
How did that come about?
That's a good question. In all likelihood, it was a combination of contact with some of my cousins who lived near us in that area where I grew up. It was a combination of that and some, I began to, you might say, be able to feel affection from people other than my family, and to recognize when other people liked me or when they were feeling affectionate toward me. And that fascinated me. And that's a part of what made me to begin to be more interested in, let's say, talking to other people or learning how to laugh was a part of that process, because most of the growing up before then, my sense of humor was completely removed from the sense of humor of people around me. But I began to be interested in how people laughed, the things they laughed at. And the other part, I think, was I just liked the sound and the kind of colors that certain people's voices evoked. And that made me want to be around those people and hear them talk.
Right. Because a little bit earlier, when you had been going through this phase of sickness, the long phase of sickness, school had been kind of a trial, it sounded like. You described the classrooms as being so light. The bells exploded in my belly and made me want to puke because of this high sensitivity. So I'm curious, how do you think you managed to stop reacting like that? Did you just get used to it over time?
I don't know that I got used to it. I think as we moved up in the grades, some things changed, such as in elementary school, we were in the same classroom the whole day. And once we got to middle school, I think they called it middle. I'm not sure if they call it middle or junior high. Then we changed classes. Once we could change classes, there was always periods in the day when I could find quiet time outside in between going from one class to another. And that really helped, because being in the same classroom all day, it was more like being trapped. And whatever smells were in that room, I had to deal with them the whole day. And whatever hiccups that might have been in the lighting, I had to deal with it all day. Whereas once we begin to have each class in a different classroom, then I really only had to deal with whatever sensory overload I might have been experiencing for an hour or hour and a half or hour and 15 minutes, and then it was going to be over.
You have a chapter called The White Castle. The White Castle, is that high school?
Yes, that's high school.
And before then, you'd been mostly surrounded by Black people, but at this stage, you were in a minority, and you became very popular within the school, it sounded like, and also asked to take on lots of duties as an African-American student, which seems to have been a bit of a burden eventually.
It was nice at first. It felt good because people recognized me and they wanted to talk to me and they liked me. But eventually it was so much that I ended up having a nervous breakdown.
Right. You said the bad witch kind of enveloped you or something like that.
Yeah, because that was the way the old people in my community, that was the way they explained the kind of illness that I had as I was having a nervous breakdown, like night sweats and being paralyzed, not being able to move, and just generally falling apart. So that their belief was that meant a witch was riding me at night. And that was causing me to kind of disintegrate emotionally and mentally.
So the bad witch riding you at night could be categorized as a folk belief. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about how you became interested in folklore.
Well, I was always interested in it because I was always around old people growing up, maybe more than around people my age. My great-grandmother helped to raise me, and she was one of the people that I felt the closest to, and I felt the most comfortable around, partly because she could be around me and not necessarily talk. And she was just sort of more intuitive about a lot of things. But she was always telling stories. And she was always using proverbs. And every night after dinner, my grandmother, my granny, would tell a lot of stories. And so we would sit around and listen to stories and laugh a lot and things like that. And a lot of those stories had to do with things that had happened to people on the plantation. So I was learning not just stories, I was learning kind of the oral history of my family going back to the slavery period. So I was always interested in folklore. It's just that I didn't know that folklore was a subject that you could actually study until I got to college and took a folklore class.
Before we get to that, I wonder if you could read a little bit about your childhood growing up on that plantation.
Okay, I'll read an excerpt about that. When the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, the Wickhams kept most of the slaves on as domestic or field hands. They kept the kingdom we had built and gave us nothing. They were never sorry. They never believed they had done anything wrong. To us, that was the essence of whiteness. I grew up watching the descendants of the slave owners pass by daily on the road that led out of the plantation, going to and from town. Sometimes they would wave at us. We'd wave back. Hi, slave owners. The road was dirt hard and bald in spots that glistened in the sun like foreheads. There were dips and potholes and spots. When it was dry, the dust from our car tires followed cars like trains of smoke. The dust got on everything, the shrubs along the road, on our skin, on hard surfaces of wood and glass in the house, down our throats. The road was like a tunnel below archways of tall trees. Fields of soybeans or corn ran along one side most of the way from Route 54 to our house. Woods ran along the other side, and then a neighbor's house, woods and fields. I walked by run-down slave quarters. I heard stories all the time about slavery. It was just yesterday. My daddy's daddy worked in the Wickham's dairy. My daddy's mama worked in the big house. She gathered eggs, churned butter, made biscuits, cleaned floors, did laundry. She cooked in a big iron skillet. My granny's mama worked in the big house. Her husband worked in the fields. I heard stories about my cousins and uncles and aunts and grandmothers and grandfathers and things that happened on the plantation. I saw their spirits all the time, walking in the yard, sitting under the elm tree. Sometimes I would go and sit with them to feel their quietness. It was like falling into a soft blanket, into the space where no one blinked, no one breathed.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
So what was college like for you?
Well, in the beginning, college was very difficult because I was really recovering from the nervous breakdown I had in high school. But I wasn't recovering very well because I didn't have any help. So when I first got to college, I was still having problems like really bad night sweats, periods of being paralyzed, crying all the time, not being able to concentrate, being really depressed. So when I first got there, dealing with those things happening to me And then being in a totally new environment, it was just too overwhelming. So I actually withdrew from college and left without telling anyone. I eventually came back, but that was the beginning of college. And then when I got back, one of my professors took me to a therapist, and that really began the process of recovering. And it was then that I started being able to see some value in college, and maybe around my junior year, I started to meet people and to have friends. So the first 2 years were just pretty dark period.
Yeah, you describe feeling like Carrie in the film based on the Stephen King novel, or like the Elephant Man. Sounds terrible.
It was pretty bad.
But then you go on from there to this chapter called The Purple Time, and you're now in Berkeley in California, and you're remembering how to be happy.
Yeah, California, when I first moved there, I did feel happier right away. I felt happy because the natural landscape was friendly. The ocean made me feel calm, and the color of the sky and the clouds and the tones of green and the trees and the grass, things like that calmed me. And so that was my first reaction to being in California, in the Bay Area. It wasn't really the people and the places. It was the colors and sounds and shapes of things and the natural environment that I just felt really at home in.
It sounds like you moved into a kind of community where meditation was quite a big thing, spirituality. Do you think that played into your feeling of happiness as well?
Well, it did, but that came later in my time in California. By then, I had a number of relationships, and I had gone to Berkeley and then to UCLA for my MA and PhDs. So all that period leading up to the commune, it wasn't all happy. there was quite a lot of hard times,
right,
in that period.
Did you get? I mean, being a graduate student myself, a PhD candidate, I'm curious to know if you got stressed out by the same sorts of things that people without Asperger's get stressed out by. You know, the deadlines, the writing, the imposter syndrome, things like that.
I don't think those were the main things that stressed me out, because, well, a couple of reasons. One is, when I was in graduate school, I didn't understand the significance of being in graduate school. I went back to graduate school because I thought it would give me time to write, and because being in school was a safe kind of environment for me, and I understood the routine and I understood what was expected. And people usually talked in quiet tones in an academic environment. So I wasn't going back to graduate school because I really wanted a graduate degree, or because I was imagining a certain career. I was going back because it was an environment that I was familiar with and I was comfortable in, and it would give me time to write and read and to, let's say, be in my own world. But I never really had much worry about for example, writing papers or anything like that. I did the academic work, but I didn't really think a lot about it in the way that I would suppose most graduate students do. And I wasn't focused on what my professors thought of my work because I wasn't thinking that I would do anything in the future that would make it matter. So those weren't really my stresses in graduate school.
Got it. It sounds like you were more stressed when you left graduate school because suddenly the structure was taken away.
That's absolutely true. And I didn't know what I was going to do or I didn't know what to do. I didn't really know how to apply for a job. I didn't know what job I could do. So I was kind of lost.
So this is the period in which you went to live in a commune, right?
I did. The Rajneesh commune in Oregon. I didn't go there immediately when I left graduate school and at UCLA. I moved up north and I was living with a partner who had been also a graduate student at UCLA while I was there. And we were just doing creative things. I was playing music and writing, and she was doing choreographed dances, and we were both very interested in spiritual things, so we did a lot of exploration of different spiritual groups. And that led to me finding my way to Rajneesh. And once I found my way to him, then I wanted to go to the commune in Oregon. I did go several times. I wasn't able to really live there because I couldn't afford it. But I would live in the commune's houses in Berkeley and then periodically take the trip to Oregon and stay for a while and do a lot of meditations there.
And it was through this that you met your first wife.
Yes, because she was a sannyasin also in that movement.
So a sannyasin is a disciple of Rajneesh.
It is. I mean, it means a spiritual disciple who's devoted to a particular path. So any followers of a particular guru would be sannyasins.
Right. And you had a son.
I did. My first son, Nick, was born, and my wife and I actually had a house that was kind of a commune house in San Francisco, and our son was born in that house.
But it sounded like you and your wife didn't actually really know each other tremendously well when you got married and had a child. I think you're right. Surviving and being in relationships seem to be two different things. Surviving and being Black with autism spectrum disorder, ASD, in cross-racial relationships seem to be many different things.
Yes. No, we didn't know each other really well. There was an assumption that many of us in the movement made, that because we were all in the movement and we shared this great love for Rajneesh, and we were all meditating and our sort of spiritual worldviews were aligned, we kind of jumped to the conclusion that that meant that everything else about us would also be aligned. And so it wouldn't matter who you married as long as they were from the group, because of course you would be totally compatible. And of course that really wasn't the case. That was a kind of naive way of thinking about relationships, but I don't think I was the only one who ended up thinking about them that way.
Oh, I'm sure not, no. Around this time, you're also beginning to teach quite a bit in schools around the Bay Area. You say you learned to wear professional man blackness. And you also talk about feeling secure in grey concrete, but also maybe somewhat trapped. So you're in these grey concrete institutions like schools and colleges and having mixed feelings about them. How did you relate to teaching? Did you enjoy it from the beginning or was it difficult?
Well, there were things I enjoyed about teaching, and I had always taught. I started teaching when I was a teenager. I started teaching Sunday school. And then when I was in undergraduate school, I taught in the Poet in the Schools program in Richmond, sometimes in school, sometimes in the prison. And so one of the things that I liked about teaching was I knew a lot of things about a lot of subjects, and teaching gave me an opportunity to talk about them. But I also enjoyed it because I enjoyed like having other people interested in those subjects and interested in learning and interested in having certain kinds of conversations. But the different teaching environments, I guess you might say, pose sets of challenges that in some cases were difficult to overcome. Like teaching in elementary school, I loved my students. I loved their energy. Their personalities, all of the little things that they would constantly come up with. But it was overstimulating because there were so many voices all the time in an elementary school. And there were the constant bells, and there were all of the sensory stimulation. The lights were overstimulating because they were the fluorescent lights that buzzed, and that sound kind of grated on me. The smells in the school, and I was very sensitive to the smells. So if you have a class of 30 students, then each student is going to be sort of like a little country of a variety of different scents, and put all 30 of them together for an entire day in the same room, and by the end of the day, that's a little bit overwhelming. So there were things I loved about teaching, but at the same time, it was a challenge. And one of the biggest challenges was I don't really like to talk. I find talking for very long to be really challenging. And as a teacher, you have to talk. It's sort of required. And you usually have to talk a lot. And teaching primary through K through 12, one has to talk at times that one didn't decide on. So if it's a college classroom, you have pretty much control over when you talk. You can structure your class so that for the first half hour of an hour, students are working on projects in small groups. And then the second half an hour, they're reporting on what they worked on, which means that as a instructor, one wouldn't need to talk very much that whole hour. But elementary school and junior high school and high school, every so often a student's going to do something that means you have to talk, whether it's acting out or whether it's, may I go to the bathroom, or that person hit me, or, you know, those kinds of things. So that's one of the biggest things that I have found difficult about being a teacher, is that I don't really like talking.
Yes, I can see that. That is a challenge. But you became a professor at the University of Missouri in Columbia, is where you're based, isn't it?
Yes.
How did that happen? Because you had talked earlier about not really being interested in the degrees for what they could provide for you career-wise. So when did it start to occur to you to apply for professor jobs?
Well, I burned out as a primary secondary teacher because of all of the problems that I was dealing with. For example, I was teaching in a what they call a high-risk population school, which meant it was a school in a very low-income area of Oakland that was almost zero resources for the school. The classrooms were overcrowded. There was a lot of drugs in the neighborhood. A lot of the kids had special needs in terms of, let's say, their parents didn't come home that night and they had to get themselves to school, or their parent might have been, let's say, have substance abuse problems and they were dealing with that, or they might be victims of some sort of abuse. So teaching really meant being a substitute parent and being a therapist and being a teacher and being a counselor, and sometimes even more, because if I got a call that one of my students had, let's say, stolen something from a convenience store, then I would need to go and sort of bail them out. So I don't even know the name for what that would be. So I burned out doing that, and I had a child. And so I knew, well, I have to work. And it occurred to me that I had gone to school and gotten an MA and gone to school for a PhD. So I thought, wait a minute, I could teach in college. So that's how that kind of light bulb switched on.
What was your dissertation on, just out of curiosity?
My dissertation was on African-American proverbs. So,
oh, wow.
So my first book, African-American Proverbs in Context, was a revision of my dissertation, which had some chapters taken out and some new things put in.
Do you have a favorite proverb?
It depends on the day. My favorite proverb today is, every mickle makes a muckle.
Every nickel makes a knuckle.
Oh, mickle. So mickle, like M-I-C-K-L-E. Every mickle makes a muckle. It's a Jamaican proverb, and it just means every little bit counts.
I like the sound of it, even if I didn't understand what it meant. So what was it like moving to Missouri? Because you loved the ocean, for example.
It was difficult because I don't like deciduous forest. And this is a sort of cross between deciduous forest and plains. I don't like oak trees, and I don't like the feeling of trees imposing on my space. So the natural environment was not comfortable for me, but also the seasons. I don't like winter, I would be happy if it were 70 degrees all year long. So the the snow and ice and that kind of thing I don't like. But then culturally, it was difficult too, because when I first moved here, the city of Columbia was more segregated. So there weren't as many minorities, and it just wasn't comfortable. I experienced quite a bit of racist attitudes from people in different businesses and that kind of thing. So, and I had never been in the Midwest. Like, there's racism in the South, but there's a lot of Black people, which is really different than being in a small city in the Midwest where you're experiencing racism and there's hardly any other Black people around. So it was frightening.
It sounds like it. And you say that you were part of this push for diversity within the university, but then there was no support given to Black professors. And there were a whole lot of new rules to follow, like don't hug people. And you describe going to a faculty party and wondering why there's no dancing.
Yeah.
So it does sound like a real adjustment, but it also sounds like you have adjusted in a way. Have you?
Well, I adjusted because necessity is the mother of invention. So I adjusted, but I'm aware that in the process, I lost some things. Not just I lost some things, but the process of being something that you're not, or not being able to be what you are over an extended period of time, not only has some negative psychological effects, but it also has some physical effects. I think it affects one's health. So I do feel that I adjusted, but I've paid for the adjustment in some ways that maybe that's just sort of hard, cold reality of being a Black disabled person in the United States, or probably any country, really.
Right. Although you do say that in some ways being a full professor, which is what you are now, is an ideal career for you because professors are already thought of as odd. So
yeah,
you have some leeway there to be odd, I guess.
Yes.
And also you married again, and this seems to be a very supportive relationship.
Well, yes, this would be my third marriage.
Right.
So, and it is very supportive, and my wife is very tuned into my autism. In fact, she was the person who insisted that I actually get tested.
You describe what led her to suspect that you might have Asperger's. You were very upset when people left cupboards open in the kitchen. And I think the turning point was not being able to find the soy sauce. And apparently you threw things everywhere and broke plates. And that's the point at which your wife realized that something was up, other than just being a bit particular about how things are arranged in cupboards.
That was a turning point for sure. It wasn't the only thing. There were other things that I don't know whether I wrote about them in the memoir or I didn't, but such as not having a typical response to other people's feelings, or being able to seemingly just disengage or disconnect in a way that I would imagine most people wouldn't be able to do. That left her feeling I was there, but I really wasn't there. So and not being able to know what I was feeling a lot of the time, whether that was physically or emotionally, just not having any ability to know. So if someone said, "Well, how are you feeling?" I don't know. Things like that. I think we're all so kind of red flags for her.
You say that you've learned to cope as a couple. Now you have your own quiet study and a flower garden, which is imbued with the spirit of your grandmother. And you try to remember that a new room is likely to be too bright, or that the sink may contain a dirty dish. You say you understand how hard it is for neurotypicals to understand Aspies, but I think the book goes a long way to explaining it. It's very evocative, like I said earlier. It's very descriptive. It's not a straightforward memoir. It's very impressionistic in places.
Yes. And I would say there's explaining, and then there's people really getting it, because my experience has been I can explain it and people can get it in a mentally they can get it, but then on some other level it's like they don't really believe it. And so when something happens, such as, let's say I'm eating dinner with people and then I just, without a word, get up and leave, their reaction is usually not to think, "Oh, well, there's something going on related to stimulation or something like that." Their reaction is usually going to be insulted. So I never assume people really on a gut level are going to internalize the explanations that I've given them, because they just go against the way that they're so accustomed to perceiving things and to interpreting other people's behavior.
Right. I understand what you mean. So we've taken up an awful lot of your time. Is there anything you want to say about your memoir that I didn't give you the chance to during the course of our interview?
There are moments such as when I'm talking about the things being better now and so forth. There's good days and there's not so good days. And most people, even though they might read the memoir, I don't think they would really know what some of the bad days are like. Because they might see me in the daytime and I seem to be normal, but they don't see me when I get home. So, and I don't know that I'd want them to, but I would want them to at least imagine that there's more to the story than what they might be seeing when I seem quote unquote normal.
I get it. Yeah. I think I have a tendency to always want things to end happily. So I guess I might have been emphasizing that a little bit in the way I was posing questions too, trying to make it all into a happy ending.
Well.
So I apologize if I was giving that impression.
That wasn't necessarily a response to you saying that, but it's more a response to my being aware that some people may read the last chapter in that way, because there are people who want to think that we outgrow autism and then it's not a problem anymore, and it just doesn't work that way.
Well, Anand Prahlad, we've taken up, like I said, a lot of your time. Before you go, I wonder if you can tell us what you're working on now, or are you having a little bit of a rest?
No, I'm working on two things. One is I'm working on another creative nonfiction book, which really looks at my family going back to slavery and giving voice to different members of that family, in the extended sense of family, who had a disability of one kind or another. So, for example, an uncle who was a slave who had a physical disability, or a cousin who was a slave who had a psychological disability. So I want to kind of write a impressionistic history of my clan going back to the slavery period by giving voices specifically to people who had disabilities. So that's one book project. And the other project, which is actually finished pretty much, is a collection of poems that all of the poems in some way explore some issue of disability, black disability, and not necessarily transgender, but non-binary or non-cisgender identity. So that's the second project that I'm pretty close to being finished with that one.
Well, those both sound like really important works, and we'll look forward to them. But in the meantime, I just wanted to thank you, Anam Prahlad, for taking the time to talk with us on the New Books in Folklore podcast about The Secret Life of a Black Aspie, your memoir. And I want to thank you for taking part and remind listeners that this New Books in Folklore podcast is one of many channels on the New Books Network. So Anam Prahlad, have a lovely rest of day, and thank you again.
Thank you, Rachel.